Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakin.
This week, Samsung's got its finger on the pulse, Kickstarter's been hacked, Candy Crush reaches a new level, Facebook adds more pronouns, Bitcoin falls due to a glitch, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and you can leave us all of our subscription links are in our show notes, and please leave us a review on iTunes if you subscribe. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down, and write to us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We're always happy to hear from you. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And this week, it's all about House of Cards, Season 2. House of Cards is back on Netflix, and I am rekindling my love with House of Cards and what it's like to swim in the ocean with the sharks that are Frank and Claire Underwood. Anybody else watching House of Cards?
Nah, I mean, like, it came out, but I was on a ski trip in Tahoe, and this
I didn't get to check out this new season, but I've heard really good things. There've been a lot of people who have known who've binge-watched either the entire season or a good chunk of it. How about yourself?
I'm about 7 episodes in on a, I think it's an 18 episode season, so almost halfway. Man, I'm really stoked about it. Like, it's really a firecracker of a series. I think that maybe because, like, they have to prepare an entire season for you know, total release. Yeah. Where on other shows where they have this production schedule where they go from week to week to week, and you could be halfway through a production schedule when you're releasing your first episode, and you get that sort of, you don't get to course correct, you don't get to course correct in time for, like, if your audience is watching the first few episodes and they hate it, and they tell you, they tell you what they want to change in the season. By this time you've already got so many episodes in the can that you cannot change direction of the show if you want to. Whereas because this whole series is being done all at once, they can edit the entire thing, look at the entire show as one whole piece.
And so you're basically saying they're doing it right, because the other way of doing TV sucks. And I put Lost up there as the poster boy.
I'm not.
We don't know what the hell's going on.
Okay, I'm not going to disagree with you that there were problems involved with not getting a big picture of your serialized arc being a problem with telling an effective story with Lost. However, I will say that they did the best that they could, and I think once Lost got an idea of when they could wrap it up, then they were able to place their tent pole pegs nicely, effectively in the rest of the show.
Unforgivable.
The other thing I've been playing with is a app on my iPhone called Whisper. And Whisper is an app that allows you to make confessions or to tell secrets anonymously, and also view other people's anonymous secrets in the form of text over pictures. And I understand that these guys aren't the only app in town that does this. There's another app, Secret, Dwayne, that you've I think you've been playing with Secret, and they kind of do the same thing. These two are like two of a kind apps.
Yeah, Coke and Pepsi, I guess. So the only thing I've really been playing with is Secret. A friend of a friend just launched it, so I'm I only knew about it because, you know, she's dating him and she said, dude, check this out. It's pretty compelling. For me, I'm not the type of person who puts a lot of super personal stuff on social media. Like a picture of my cat, that'll go up, right? Yeah. Positive things will go up. Hey, I checked in here. Look how exciting I am to eat this food. Look at this jump my friend did on the mountain. But I'm not the type to necessarily like complain or put down like some emotional heartfelt thing on social media. But that's because, you know, that stuff is relatively public, and with Secret, it's not. You have like a close group of friends. It figures out anonymously who's who by looking at your address book. It just throws the stuff up there, and you can kind of say whatever you think you need to say. So for people who are very solution-oriented like me, I had a little trouble understanding these apps and their appeal. Or for people who actually gain comfort and catharsis from just getting something off their chest by putting it out there in the ether on the nets, and having anonymous people respond to it, that's helpful. And I think that there's a lot of room for apps like this to move forward, especially in the age of Snapchat, where it's like not about accountability. Like, it's bringing the internet back to what it used to be. Like being able to privately and anonymously put something down and not having to take a lot of shit for it. You know what I mean? So I mean, it's a pretty cool thing. You know how many friends you have right now. So like, if you don't have many, you might be able to figure out who's who.
Yeah. See, that's the difference. I think that's the difference between Secret and Whisper, is that Whisper doesn't have the sort of social network connectivity as much as Secret does.
So Secret is focusing on like you get a kind of zeitgeist of your overall social circle, right? And if you have a lot of people who are connected with it, obviously it's growing, right? But I think I have like 40 people connected with it right now. And I have no idea who's who. But another friend of mine, she only has 8 people connected with it, so she has a better idea of who's who, right? But that zeitgeist is helpful. And there is reflection. As much as I don't write on Secret, I read it, and it does make me contemplate. Like, if I hear or I've read a problem that someone's expressing, as a person who's like highly solution-oriented, I will look inward. Like, how did I deal with that, or how would I deal with that? And that, to me, is where I get my catharsis. So I'm excited about where this is heading. And it's kind of exciting to see apps that are just kind of like actually dealing with emotional issues for adults, right? Like this is a new format of app. Like, I'm trying to help you deal with, I'm trying to give you an outlet for your emotional situation via your smartphone, and one that's non-judgmental or doesn't lead to judgments or whatever. And I think that's pretty exciting. So I think Secret has a bright future. Chris Bader, the guy behind it, I think he's got a good thing going.
Yeah, I'll have to check Secret out and compare it to
One thing to do
Whisper.
Is Secret is iOS only, and if you're looking for it, type in Secret, space, INC, because the word Secret could lead to a million things on the App Store, the iPhone App Store, iOS App Store. So
sure.
You want to type in Secret, space, INC, Secret Inc. It'll come up. You'll get it. It's cool. It's got a little white icon with kind of a drawing of a fox on it.
Oh, cool. Tosin, are you playing with anything?
Nothing new this week.
Alrighty, cool. Well, let's move on into headlines then. According to Sam Mobile, Samsung's upcoming flagship will come with a fingerprint sensor one that's embedded in, and this is the, I'm sorry, this is the Galaxy S5 that we're talking about.
That's funny because it's called the Galaxy S5, and the current phone with this fingerprint sensor is called the 5S.
That's right.
So for anyone who's ever thought that Apple doesn't lead the crowd on this.
You think there was an intentional confusion made in the, like, intentionally, like Samsung's intentionally trying to confuse the market by calling their phone the S5?
I have to say no to that. This is probably the only time that'll happen, right? So, like, Apple has this, what's been determined with the 4S is a cycle. You have your number, and then you have your number with an S behind it. Samsung makes a new phone every year called the Galaxy insert number here S.
Yeah, sure.
So next year, Samsung will have the Galaxy 6S, and iPhone will have the iPhone 6. And when Apple has the iPhone 6S, Samsung will have the Galaxy 7S.
So this S5 has the.
So it's always going to be slightly confusing.
Yeah.
But, you know, whatever. The bottom line is Samsung usually highlights its telephone with the white version, which Apple's doing this time. Yeah. Fingerprint sensors, S5, 5S. This time around, it could cause a little customer confusion.
There's a reporting, according to reports, there are some differences between the way the fingerprint sensor works on this, on the Samsung S5 as opposed to the iPhone 5S.
Oh, doesn't forget like the iPhone 5S does. Every 2 weeks, I'm re-inputting my fingerprint.
The people who've used the S5 say that you need to swipe your finger from the base to the tip across the button, and the authentication will fail if your hands are wet. The phone can store up to 8 fingerprints in order to do things such as launch particular apps or verify their accounts. And some of the stored fingerprints can be used to access two new features called Personal Folder and Private Mode, where users can keep apps, widgets, and files for their eyes only.
See, that's tight. The idea that you can, like, I mean, it's kind of funny to think, okay, I'm going to use my pinky now to get in there. But other than that, the idea that you can have a private mode on your phone is a big deal. I mean, that's going to be used. Biometrics are going to be used. The question is, how Samsung's dealing with the data. Apple has said time and again, and this put reports out there, white papers showing that your fingerprint data is stored, you know, encrypted within the A7, system on a chip. Right.
Not in the cloud.
It's not going to the cloud. No one can read it. You're simply talking to your phone, and then your phone talks to the cloud based on the fact that it's got a pass or fail situation. Samsung on Android, it's unclear how they're doing it. Will we see this on a Galaxy phone? If the Galaxy 5S, mm-hmm. S5 Nexus version comes out, will Android have this touch support natively in it? You know, it's going to be interesting.
So it's actually really interesting, and I think it is a good play to be able to have biometrics that really really can expose and hide sensitive information. And really that is the direction that we're going with all devices, be it, you know, your laptop, your cell phone. I think biometrics, although we've been saying this for a while, it truly is the wave of the future. Because if you really think about it, how many people care to remember passwords that are complex enough to really keep them safe? Yeah. And also, to a certain extent, even with that sort of, you know, complex password, we're seeing, you know, data being hacked left and right.
Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't. There are going to be cultural problems. If you're like me and you share accounts with your partner,
yeah,
biometrics becomes a problem, right? Things like sharing a password, sharing a passcode, sharing or whatever. If it's solely left up to biometric data, then, you know, that's annoying. You know, like if I'm going to the ATM and I have to put my thumb down in order to get my stuff because my PIN is no longer in use, and that's just like a decade off, whatever. That's annoying for when I'm a little intoxicated and I want my girlfriend to take some money out for me.
Yeah.
Right, or I'm cooking and I need her to go take some money out of the ATM for me while she's making a run to go buy something. So that's that's just something, as a person who has like an integrated life, commingled finances, yada, 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 like that is a little bit in the way. Like right now, you know, I have like, however many, I think it's 5 fingerprints the phone takes in, the iPhone 5S. She has 2 of them, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's, if I want to change anything, like when I got a new phone, because I'm about to replace my 5S, I had to find a time to sit her down. Be like, can I put your finger on my phone, please? And it's a little annoying that we have to go through all that. It'd be cool if you could just authorize somebody and their shit was in the cloud and it was secure, but that's not happening for some time.
That all may change as the usage of mobile devices changes, evolves. Like, you know, I'm still waiting for iOS to allow multiple users on one account.
Yeah, I mean, that's not in the interests of the people who make iOS devices. They're personal communication devices. They're not joint communication devices. It's just not. It would mean that they'd lose the margin. You don't buy each of your kids an iPad mini. You buy one iPad mini, and they have different accounts in them. While it may come in the far-flung future, I just don't I don't see that helping their stock price.
Yeah. But they have to – eventually, you would think they would have to
The only way they're doing it is if someone else does it first, and it's wildly popular.
Right, right. Okay, let's move on here. So Kickstarter's been hacked. This makes like the I think it's now an even dozen of social networks that I've subscribed to that have in one way or another been hacked. Kickstarter sent out an email about the breach. On last Wednesday, they said no credit card data was accessed, but hackers did gain access to usernames, email addresses, mailing addresses, phone numbers, and encrypted passwords. Encrypted passwords. Recommended.
Hopefully everything was encrypted.
Yeah. 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 Well, it doesn't say anything, but the passwords are encrypted. Mm. They encouraged everybody to create new passwords for their accounts, and I got my email last week. For that, and they apologized for the breach. They said, "We're incredibly sorry that it happened. We set a very high bar for how we serve our community. We've since improved our security procedures and systems, and will continue to do so in weeks and months to come." I just hear reports of these sites getting hacked more and more frequently.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to see that more and more frequently because people have gotten to, I mean, like, there's this business here. For me, I haven't heard about PayPal being hacked, and I haven't heard about Chase being hacked, and I haven't heard about Kiva being hacked. These are financial, you know, financial-based technologies. Chase is just a financial institution, so they've got certain things they just have to be doing. In light of what happened with Target, in light of what's happened with Sony, and this, I'm beginning to think that the regulations that we use for financial institutions are the type that have to go across multiple services. If you take my credit card, yeah, you have to use these protections. And while that is going to no doubt be burdensome,
yeah,
on, yeah, you know, a lot of organizations, the fact is many of the carts that are used, the electronic cart software that's used, they'd be able to integrate this kind of functionality. And then it's a question of your database has to be handled in a way that, you know, PayPal handles it, that Kiva handles it, that Chase handles it. They're all doing something right because they have really sensitive information and they know they have to protect in order to keep the sanctity of their relationship with their customers. And, you know, there's been this huge push to just kind of get everything up and running. And that's the way the internet should be. Just, you know, rushing is fine.
Yeah.
But infrastructure needs to be stronger.
Absolutely. No.
And the fact is that you look at PayPal and this hasn't happened. Yeah. They're doing something right. Others should follow.
Yes. Well, I mean,
To our knowledge.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
that's a good point.
The one thing which
they have to disclose. If it happened, they'd have to disclose. And if they didn't disclose, somebody in their organization, They're not like they haven't taken an oath. Someone in the organization would leak it. If PayPal were breached, I have no doubt that.
But there are some situations.
Depends what type of breach it is. Yeah. I think
if it were breached at all. it's PayPal. If it were breached at all, the data would come out. If it was a bank like Chase or Citibank or whatever, they by law have to tell you. If it was Kiva, they'd be willing to tell you.
There's some situations, not with PayPal or Chase, but with other organizations where they were breached and they did disclose it, but not immediately. They took their sweet time, you know, up to a number of months before they disclosed that there was
or a breach. Or even years, because remember, Steam was also breached in a certain regard, and they told people a long time after.
Mm-hmm. Steam's breach happened, I think, before the culture was ready to accept the news, and they were not living in the culture we live in now, where this shit happens, you tell people immediately. It was more.
I still worry about this whole "you tell people immediate" factor, because I don't feel like anyone does tell people immediately, right? According to the letter we received from Kickstarter, it said it happened Wednesday night, and I know it does take time to figure out the facts, but it wasn't really an immediate, you know, they reported it on Friday.
Not the next day it happened, but, you know.
Or Saturday. Actually, it was Saturday night, I think they reported
it. So when I say immediately, I don't mean like the minute it happens, right? That's just not feasible, especially because you have to figure out if it happened at all. I've worked for a company that did suffer a data breach, and it took them it was weeks after the heist was done before they noticed the issue had showed up. See what I'm saying?
Right, but as soon as it's reported, I feel like in this day and age, 24 hours, you should be able to at least get suitable information to notify users. Because if you really think about it, from a user perspective, you want to know as soon as you can so that you can change those passwords. So you can, you know, cancel the cards.
So one of the big issues is that the liability doesn't sit with the user. If your credit card gets stolen, the liability sits right now on the – it sits somewhere between the vendor that had your information and the credit card – the bank issuing the credit card. That's why when these things happen, no one's sitting there saying, oh, man, I'm broke because of this breach. There'd be, you know, something happens. The credit card company notices that you bought, you know, a steamship in Germany. They're like, this probably wasn't you, and they deal with it. So some of these rules are changing. This whole after the Target breach and Neiman Marcus, there have been some right. rules saying, hey, once this whole chip thing shows up, the pin and chips thing shows up, and here in the U.S., it's the liability is going to fall squarely on the retailer if they're not up to snuff with the codes that we like lay out. And I have a feeling that when you look at companies like like PayPal and so on. They know that if they have any kind of reach, they're going to want to figure out details and stuff. And you talk to the authorities too, and the authorities will tell you when best to notify your public. So there's all that. But the fact that it's timely notification is part of the culture is now. Target didn't tell people for 4 days, and they got slammed by the press about it. No company wants that PR hit, even if it's a question of like it's not a legal issue or whatever. They just don't want that PR hit. They want to know that they have a relationship with their customers. It's not going to falter and drive the customer to the other side. And so I know that the Steam got hit. I think it was before the current culture that says let people know soon. It'll never be the moment it happens because people have to figure out that it's happened and people have to figure out the appropriate response and so on and so forth.
But you can't let it lapse too long. Otherwise, the compromised accounts are still liable to be compromised, to stay compromised.
Well, and that's one of the things, too. Like, if Target didn't say anything for a very long time, the guys who issue the banks that issue the credit cards that people used would sue Target.
Yeah.
Right? Like, none of the... Because they're liable. None of that stuff is just kind of like out there and hitting the consumer firsthand. Because it can't, because consumers will put their money under their mattresses or pay in cash and nobody will make money. So they have to, and that's how the internet started. When online purchasing became, in order for it to become a default, the banks said, hey, look, no matter what happens to your stuff, if there's fraud, if your stuff gets stolen, we'll take care of it. We guarantee that we'll take care of it. And that's how it opened up. You know, the banks had to take the risk, and they're still taking the risk. And now they're putting that on top of the retailers with these new rules. But the fact is, there are services that have not been breached, and maybe it's just a matter of time. But the fact that these services have wonderful information for the baddies to use, and they haven't been breached yet, shows that they're putting emphasis in some of the right places, and it'd be nice to know that others are doing the same. That's my point.
I think we can all agree there.
Yep. Yep. Let's move on here. Either of you guys play Candy Crush?
No.
I get an invite for Candy Crush every single day from either my aunt in Georgia or from my friend's mother in Singapore.
I know a lot of people. One of my oldest friends is addicted to Candy Crush, and I've never played it, so I don't understand the addiction. I'm afraid to play it because I don't want to be addicted to it. I'm already addicted to The Simpsons Tapped Out.
Is it really because you just don't want to play it and cry?
It's gonna move me terribly. in relation to a conversation we had before the show started,
or the fact that you said you played BioShock Infinite and you cried.
Man, that has a very moving ending to that game.
I have not played it.
I think you cried during Little Big Planet too.
Those little sack boys, man, they're really they're really emotional. But Candy Crush is a huge a runaway hit, and the company that the publisher, King Digital Entertainment, out of Ireland, has filed initial IPO papers with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and they want to trade under the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker King, K-I-N-G. Last year, King generated profits of $568 million on a revenue of $1.88 billion. And almost all that growth comes from the one game, Candy Crush. It generates 78% of their revenue. A staggering 93 million people play it every day. So this is phenomenal. Now, the question is really, though, can King Digital Entertainment become another Rovio, the company that makes Angry Birds, or are they going to be a Zynga where you hit big initially and then just kind of suffer subsequent losses from quarter after quarter because you can't keep that magic rolling?
Yeah, I mean, the game industry is really finicky, and it's a very hard one to get into. I mean, you've probably noticed from the major news about some of the publishers that have actually, you know, gone out of business. Major publishers who are making large games, or at least folded in. Speaking of BioShock, right?
Irrational Games.
Yeah. Okay. So let's put this in perspective before we get to like.
Sure.
There is no overarching game industry that is associated with what we're talking about today. The guys who make what gets played on your PS3 or your Xbox or your Steam box or your computer are not the guys in Zynga, Rovio, and King.
Right.
The social game market is a completely different market with completely different metrics, needs, challenges. And it needs to be understood that way. It's very different.
I think there is still some overlap
I think that there's obviously overlap because they're software manufacturers. But when you're talking about these immersive cinematic games, you know, you can go anywhere from VentureBeat to Gizmodo, and they'll be like, these are just very different economic models, very different focus. Those games, let's follow the money. You start with the games that are on these high-end devices like the Xbox and everything, and they're about game sales. You look at the games that are making money like Rovio and Zynga and stuff, and they're, you know, for the most part, maybe not Rovio, but for the most part, they're about in-game purchases and so on.
Yeah.
And that leads to a very different level. There's a different dynamism when it comes to what's going on there.
Sure, it's all
when it
DLC.
Comes to what Rovio's doing, when it comes to what King is doing, you know, frankly, whether they're going to be a success and have a million different games or not doesn't actually matter. The IPO is the only time where they're going to get the influx of cash. So it's kind of a question: if you IPO when your product is strong enough to get the interest to have a strong initial public offering, if you're smart, you'll take some of that money and invest it, diversify it, save it, whatever, so that if things don't work out, you'll still have a lot of cash. But the fact of the matter is, the IPO is where the company actually gets its money from. And then it's kind of all out in the open, and your stock rises and falls as would any other stock. So it's the right thing for them to do financially, move while they have the muscle into the public space to get the kind of initial investment that could either A, allow them to grow the company in a new direction because of the initial investment, or B, allow them to make a ton of cash off of what is an incredibly popular game, and if they need to, exit. It's either a scheme or it's a reinvestment in their stuff. But either way, now's the time to get the money because you're not going to be alive forever.
So from that perspective, I definitely agree. If you are going to go public, this is the time for them. But I still, in terms of whether or not they can be successful as a ongoing organization after being public and now being beholden to the standards of investors,
right,
I question that, especially from what we've seen from Zynga and a lot of the other companies that have come into this space. And, to tell you the truth, King's organization is not really making very many friends within the greater, the greater community in terms of, their legal tactics and things of that nature when it comes to, trying to, I think did you guys hear about them trying to copyright the word candy and other things of that nature?
Yeah, ridiculous.
Yeah,
well,
so.
Try. candy will never be a copyrighted word outside of, a description that is very, very tight and tied to Candy Crush. So, but if they have representation, the representation is going to say, yeah, let's give it a shot, because that's what I would do, right? Like you can try to protect it if you want. Now, people who are not popular, if you want to talk about popular and copywriting, let's look at Zynga for a second. Let's look at all of the various Mattel games that Zynga's made copies of, even though and Hasbro games, even though these games were figured out in the last century, and they were on a board. Zynga did the non-creative thing to just copy them and throw them online via an app. And, are we going to give them a pass? I don't know.
No, definitely not.
That's a lot worse than just trying to take a word like candy and copyright it.
Well, I mean, it's a combination, right? Taking the word candy, but also suing people who've had games out that have the word candy in there that may have come before your game. But that's a whole nother...
But that's not how trademark works. Trademark isn't about who came first necessarily. It never has been. So we just have to realize that that's like the straight up traditional legal process. If I'm putting money behind a phrase or word and someone's out there that can cause customer confusion, I'm going to do what I can do to infringe upon their ability to cause customer confusion vis-a-vis my ability to spread my message. That's just normal legal parlance. You can't write CITI in front of anything, not even a nail shop, because Citigroup owns that, even though it's a cool way to spell city, right? You can't make city cereal because Citigroup's like, that could cause the kind of confusion that people think that we're making a cereal now. It's just how it is.
Let's briefly discuss the Irrational Games thing since you mentioned it, Tosin. So Irrational Games, who made Bioshock and Bioshock Infinite, is run by Ken Levine. They announced this week that they're moving on to they're laying off most of their staff, and Ken Levine is moving on to a new smaller developer within their publisher, Take-Two Interactive. He says he's winding down Irrational Games as you know it. He also said he wants to make narrative-driven games for the core gamer that are highly replayable to foster the most direct relationship with our fans possible. We'll focus exclusively on content delivered digitally. This is quite a change for Ken Levine and the team that was Irrational Games. And I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think I'm trying to guess at what he means by exclusively on content delivered digitally. I'm thinking that it's probably something along the lines of like the Walking Dead game. But I actually really like the full epic storytelling that Irrational Games did with the BioShock and BioShock Infinite. And I'm sorry that he's moving away from that.
It sounds like Irrational Games was so tied to this personality that when he wanted to change and take a different chapter in his life, you know, like he's done this immersive narrative game thing. Like, why, you know, it's time to try something different.
It's, you know, just a shame because so few people do it like Ken Levine. Like, the only other team that I can think of is Valve with Gabe Newell. They are really sort of the premier. The two of them are the premier storytellers in.
You don't think Roxy has it? Rockstar, rather.
Oh, Rockstar. Rockstar, it's kind of a different. Actually, I will give I'll give Rockstar props for Red Dead Redemption and GTA 5 a little bit. They're just not on the same level as the storytelling with Valve games and with the BioShock games.
I mean, it just sounds like he's done doing this. He doesn't want to be a guy who's just known for this. He wants to try something different and new. And given his success with his other games, I completely see that. It's like Woody Allen that never watches his movies again.
Right. Right, you know? Not the early ones, right?
Well, no, he said recently in an interview he never watches any of his movies again. Once it's made, he moves on. And that's, for some people, that's part of the creative process. We've all seen it with artists that are, like, musical artists or whatever. Their stuff changes over time. They're trying to do different things. You listen to an early Kanye West album versus the current one, and you're like, what the hell's going on? Where did this guy – when did he change like this? Right. And that's because a lot of these artists are focused on their own personal growth. It's not about just pumping out the same sort of hit for the consumer. Hopefully the consumer moves with them. And if not, then hopefully they get a new consumer. But either way, they're trying to keep their product in line with their changing interests. So, I mean, I totally understand why this is disappointing for fans.
Yeah.
But, I think part of it is just the respect of the people who put it together. So, it's not to say that somebody won't show up, a student of his or whatever, that's going to...
Someone to carry the torch? Thing.
Yeah. If there's a market for these sort of immersive games, it's going to maintain. It's like people said 10 years ago that PC gaming was dead. But it isn't, because there's such a market for it.
I'm all about the immersive narrative in video games, and I love to see it. I want to see more of it.
Yeah, I mean, there still are some companies that are able to do it. You know, Naughty Dog for one. But I think it is sad with that regard, that the torch is sort of passing on, and really sad that there are a lot of individuals from what was a pretty awesome company who are now, you know, losing their jobs and having to find other things, so
I didn't want to downplay that. That's definitely an important factor to consider.
Right. By the way, as a
developer, you can find work.
Hard to say. Game developer is one thing, right? I think the game market in general is just so volatile that it can be very difficult at times. Stability.
You can strike off on your own. Small, like, more than one time have we seen a big company like this fall apart or change direction, and splinter groups come out and they create wonderful independent games. And there's never been a better time to create an independent digital game than now, when the big guys are seeking out these digital games for their consoles for differentiation. Mobile is a new place where everyone's looking for the next digital game. Yeah. And I think that could be it.
That's probably what Ken Levine is tuned into, is that factor.
Like, you know, now is the time. Now, if you're going to have to do it on your own without a big name to go to Microsoft and say, hey, I want to make a game for your Xbox, now's the time, because everyone's searching for the smallest little game to be the next little big planet.
Okay, let's move on here. So Facebook, which has long been on the prowl for the next Instagram, appears to have found it. They're going to shell out roughly $16 billion. $16 billion. That's 16.
I got $19 billion.
Oh, the report that I have says 16. Well, 16 or 19. That's still dozens of, nearly dozens of billions of dollars more than their last acquisition, Instagram. They're going to acquire WhatsApp, which is a giant global messaging app. And I have to admit that I'm not familiar with this app at all. I don't do a lot of IM-ing. But Facebook said that they are they're going to let WhatsApp continue to operate independently, much the way they do with Instagram. According to Facebook, more than 450 million people use WhatsApp each month. 70% are active on any given day, and they're adding more than a million registered users every day. Do you use WhatsApp, Dwayne?
I do indeed. I look at WhatsApp and I see a value proposition in terms of steady growth, you know, more than 10 times the users that Instagram had at 450 million, about half of the users that Facebook currently has. So the ability to properly integrate is helpful.
Yeah.
Anyone who has an iOS device knows that if they have the Messenger app, the Facebook Messenger app and the Facebook app, every time they hit the messages thing on Facebook, it pops it over to this other app that they're trying to make the default super message app of the world. You can talk on it. You can, like, you know, put pictures. You can do, you can, obviously you can, I am. But it is a little messy. And WhatsApp has been focused on that, just the way that Instagram was focused on images in a way that the Facebook camera app wasn't. Mobile is obviously an important space for Facebook to stay in and stay on top of. WhatsApp allows for constant communication. I use it for group communication when I'm at an event, like I'm on a snowboarding vacation and there are like 20 of us in the house and we're all over the mountain. That's an easy way to use WhatsApp. It's also pretty helpful for if you've got any family or friends overseas and you want to be able to have a text conversation with them. Like you would be SMSing them, but you don't want to have them or you pay the crazy fee, international, you know, texting fees, which are considerable, especially if they're not a person who's going to be using iMessage or BlackBerry Messenger or any platform-based messaging system. It's cross-platform and it gets out there. And the best part about it all is that it's wildly popular and it does what Kik used to do or Kik still does, which is to take a look at your contacts and basically pair you up. You can have single chats, you can have group chats, you can do whatever you want. Unlike Google Plus, which is an app which has this feature, it's not doing all the other things that a social media app needs to do. So your battery hit is less. The notifications are very straightforward. This person said this thing. And yeah, I think it's a solid platform. It's a very mature platform for this kind of communication. You know, like I'm not a crazy hardcore financial analyst. Mm-hmm. 19 billion seems about 9 billion too much for me, or 16 billion seems about 6 billion too much for me.
It is fairly insane, isn't it? Yeah,
it's a lot. It's not just cash. It's there's stock involved too. Yeah. And if you're Facebook, you know that's a something that you can give away relatively cheaply that you know people want. But the fact of the matter is that I look at this product, I look at the big purchases from the last couple of years, like Instagram, like the chase down for Snapchat and for the recent Yahoo acquisition of Tumblr. And I'm looking at numbers that are and I look at the you know, like the cost of hardware stuff like Motorola and the cost of Nest, and this number does seem a bit inflated to me. I don't know that we're going to see Facebook stock go up tomorrow because of this announcement. It may go down. But at the same time, you know, this is a piece of digital real estate that has incredible growth. And Facebook, once integrating these individuals into its system, if they're not integrated already, is going to see, you know, growth. It's almost as if they're buying a different country and they're making them all citizens. It's that kind of thing. So it's a good move for Facebook in terms of maintaining relevance in the digital communication space.
Right, and I think it's actually a very good move for Facebook because WhatsApp is very, very popular internationally. And that's actually how I first heard about it. You know, I'd heard about it before, but I never really used it until I went international and everyone was using it and said, hey, I should pick it up, because it really, as Dwayne said, it allows you to do basically SMS without having to pay the outrageous fees, as well as really stay in touch with people. And that's how I stay in touch with, you know, a lot of family members that are currently not in in the States. So really, I think it's very astute to say they really did acquire another country, and they acquired a lot of users now that, you know, some of which they may have been losing to other, you know, social networks, or people who are just weren't using Facebook as much, because we've heard of the articles where which say that, you know, they are sort of hemorrhaging some of their user base. So right. Now you have a sort of dedicated group of people who have an app that fits their needs, and if you can incorporate it or even run it standalone, you keep them connected to that Facebook ecosystem. The price is a bit weird. It does seem overinflated, but
you know what? If it staunches the inevitable death of Facebook, then it was totally worth the $19 billion.
I still don't know that I see an inevitable death for Facebook, I have to say. I will say that what we can't see here, what we don't see here, is whether or not this was part of a larger bidding war. It's very possible that someone else was looking into WhatsApp, and Facebook decided that this is the number that they need to drop in order to gain access to the WhatsApp product. Simple as that. If you're Facebook and you know Google's been chasing down WhatsApp, or Apple was chasing down WhatsApp, then I can really see Google looking into it, really. Then you're going to do what you got to do. And $19 billion in stock is a small price to pay. When you think about the overall stock valuation that Facebook has right now, which is huge. So, you know, they probably won't be making a big purchase like this anytime soon again.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. The number, so I agree, the number seems, it does, like, just me and Tosin in total agreement, it seems kind of high. We just don't know what they were up against, right? Now, right. It seems high if it was just like, hey, I think you're valued at this, boom. It doesn't seem that high if, hey, Google had been like, well, Snapchat didn't go for $3 billion, so I'm going to give you $8 billion. And then Facebook is like, I'll give you 10. And Google's like, I'll give you 15. And they're like, I'll give you 19. And then at that point, you're like, okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and all of this stuff may come out in the next few months as the as this story and the purchase is picked apart over the next over time. We may discover who else was bidding for it and what it's and get a sense of its real valuation. And I agree with you. I don't think Facebook stock's going to go up much on this news. All right, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called It's Complicated, The Social Lives of Network Teens. How's that for a segue? By Dana Boyd. I've actually seen Dana Boyd speak regarding she was talking about. When I saw her speak was social memes. She's really sort of tuned into social networks and how people use the internet in a social capacity. In this book, she explores how social media affects the quality of teens' lives. She uncovers some of the major myths regarding teens' use of social media, explores tropes about identity, privacy, safety, danger, and bullying, and argues that society fails young people when paternalism and protectionism hinder teenagers' abilities to become informed, thoughtful, and engaged citizens throughout their online interactions. So it's an interesting book to check out. If you're curious as to what makes young social media users tick. And to download that free audiobook, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Or you can choose from any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles. And you also get the 30-day trial to check out their service. Whether you like the service or not, you can ditch it and you still get to keep the book for free. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Facebook offers users more choices than just he or she. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Facebook last week updated to let users choose the gender pronoun they associate with. Aside from the usual male and female options, users can choose up to 10 different gender definitions to describe themselves out of more than 50 options, including cisgender, transgender, and intersex. Not only will it show up on that user's about page, but it'll show up in all of the pronouns on the site that refer to that user. That way users will not only show up as he, him, she, her, but some may show up with the neutral they, there. So, for example, instead of getting a prompt that says write on Joey's wall for his birthday, it'll say write on Joey's wall for their birthday. While the change may not mean much for those it affects, it means a great deal, said Facebook publicist Will Hodges. We see this as one more way we can make Facebook a place where people can express their authentic identity. I'm really happy for Facebook that they did this. This is a terrific change, and it's one that I think that, like, I think they're trailblazing here in a way that other social networks should take note of, because it's one of those seemingly minor points that don't get enough attention, but people, I mean, it really makes a big difference to people that they are referred to in the way that they prefer to be known.
I still haven't given my gender to Facebook, so it says there for me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's great that they're giving people options. The press release, the talk about it. Part of me thinks that there's a huge swing. They're looking at the fact that the country's swinging toward marriage equality and so on, and they're saying, how can we be a part of it? It's appropriate, in the U.S. at least. I know in Thailand they have different genders that we don't have here. So I guess I don't know what to say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the next evolution in terms of what Facebook has to offer for identification, as well as because, you know, ultimately they have a huge catalog of people around the world. But it's kind of interesting that this happened now, especially after, you know, what Google did for the Olympics, which we believe spoke about last week, where they, you know, made their own sort of statement in terms of
being a LGBT friendly Google Doodle.
Right, exactly. And so it kind of all although, you know, this may have been planned for a while, the timing is a little interesting.
Do you see this as the forerunner to other social networks doing the same thing?
I mean, sure. I don't know if they'll have big announcements about it, but I can see it just kind of happening.
Right.
All right, let's move on here. The chairman of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, laid out several new proposals for network neutrality rules in a statement this Tuesday, also saying that the agency won't appeal a court decision that struck down their previous attempt at rulemaking. That was the one that was pushed by Verizon. We spoke about that in an earlier episode of The Drill Down. The statement, which comes amid reports that internet providers are slowing sites like Netflix, said that the FCC would explore ways to stop improper blocking and discrimination. Tom Wheeler said, quote, "I intend to accept that invitation by proposing rules that will meet the court's test for preventing improper blocking and discrimination amongst internet traffic and identifying key behaviors by broadband providers that the commission would view with particular skepticism." His words are unlikely to prevent much comfort to those alarmed by the specter of internet giants favoring certain websites over others or forcing sites like Netflix and Google to pay extra to guarantee fast delivery speeds. Because rulemaking process is slow and convoluted, and most broadband providers are going to do what they're going to do in the meantime.
Yeah, I mean, it's clear that net neutrality is a big deal. The FCC, why they don't want to go up to the courts again, they don't think they got a strong enough case or don't have the budget to do it. It's unclear. I think it's probably the former. And when something does happen, when an egregious case can be laid out, then and only then will they hit the court again, or they'll exercise their authority with the thing that they have. It'll go to the courts, and it'll be like more cut and dry, more crystal clear that this is an issue. So, yeah, I think that's kind of what we're seeing, a biding of time.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I'm hopefully that this, like I said, this carries some weight behind it, because I would sure love to see some sort of regulation set. Okay, moving on. The Japanese exchange Mt. Gox has long been one of the Bitcoin community's most prominent institutions, but also it's been one of the biggest PR headaches for Bitcoin, as heavy trading occasionally causes their servers to freeze up, triggering collapses in the currency's value. Last week, Mt. Gox announced a suspension of Bitcoin withdrawals, which sent the price of Bitcoins on the exchange into a tailspin from a high of more than $1,000 per month to below $400. Mt. Gox says that they're working hard to address the technical issues that led to the suspension of Bitcoin withdrawals. But even so, it's going to take a long time for Mt. Gox to rebuild the trust that has been lost over the last year. And they are the premier Bitcoin trading institutions. Customers who rely on any one particular Bitcoin-based business could get burned if that business fails. This is why, like, I feel like cryptocurrency is sound, but in particular because we're in the early days, the Wild West days of the development of cryptocurrency, that
support is limited.
Yeah, like this is like, I would not get into Bitcoin. I would not invest in Bitcoin at this stage of the game.
Well, it's all about your position. If you're dabbling in Bitcoin, this doesn't change your life. If you can afford to put some money into Bitcoin and use it for actual commerce, then you're in good shape. If you're trying to make your fortune off of owning Bitcoins, then volatility is going to hit you.
Yeah.
And I mean, there are other cryptocurrencies aside from Bitcoin that in terms of growth are doing better. One of them is up 10,000% in the last 6 months.
Are you referring to Dogecoin?
Yeah, I believe so. So
if Dogecoin.
If you threw your money in there, you'd have a lot of freaking money.
Sure.
It's like any investment. You just have to understand what you're willing to risk.
Yeah.
And know that if it doesn't go well, then that risk is lost.
Well, right now, like, the major risk is, are they, will they be considered a viable currency over the long term? You know, it took centuries for the American dollar, for basically any currency, takes a long time to establish.
No, it only took about 60 years for the American dollar to establish itself. Less than that. It came out in like 1800. By 1850, it was really pretty powerful. By 1900, it was being used across, it was looked at across the world because of our industry. So it doesn't take a long time for a currency to show up, especially a fiat currency.
And government sanctioned fiat currencies at that.
Yeah, and Bitcoin is not truly fiat. It is based on a process. So when we had the gold standard, our currency was like anything else. It was based on gold. It was good out the gate. Bitcoin is still basing it on mining. The value goes up and down, but the regularity and availability of Bitcoins is continuous. So there is stability there.
Now, I will say it is a sort of the market where if you currently go into Bitcoin, you know that you are taking some risk because, as you've seen, you know, there's the stability of that particular, you know, organization, servers, as well as there. I think recently, for those who had money in the new iteration of the Silk Road, they were hacked and all their Bitcoins were taken.
Well, Silk Road was at first it was taken down. Mm-hmm. Just being taken down hit the value of the currency, and then the new iteration,
had been hacked. Yep. So. Yeah.
Now, you can argue that the majority of what goes on the Silk Road is illegal, and part of the risk in involving yourself into that is, you set yourself up for perhaps losing all of your all of what you have invested in it. But I think the principle is that there shouldn't be that much percentage of risk with any currency.
I don't know. I think that's the whole point. Not every currency is supposed to be the same. That's why you have currency traders every day buying pounds, dollars, rubles, because currency fluctuates, and they want to see if they can beat get themselves in a position to buy low and sell high, and Bitcoin is in that mix.
Now, have you guys picked up any Bitcoins since you started discussing it at all, or any actually other currency, including
Dogecoin? I have a piece of a Bitcoin. You can't. I'm not. I don't have a whole Bitcoin.
No, I don't own any Bitcoin.
I keep finding out more and more friends who've been interested in mining Dogecoins, and it's actually a kind of a crazy market and experience in how it's all done. It's definitely an interesting read for those listeners out there that are curious on the sort of things. But
I get all these computers that are powerful enough to mine these coins to focus a little bit of their attention on folding for like cancer proteins. Oh,
right.
Oh.
Right. I did quite a bit of that when the PS3 had a folding app. But since they got rid of it from their OS, I haven't been able to do it. Okay, so that's it for our major headlines. We're going to take one last break. And when we come back, what happens when 80,000 people simultaneously play one game of Pokemon? Our drill down video of the week is next. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cercini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Adefawakin.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello again.
Twitch Plays Pokemon is an amazing phenomenon. Basically what this is thousands of people all simultaneously giving inputs to an emulator of classic Pokemon Red version game, or just spectating, just watching the frustrating madness unfold. The game streaming service Twitch has been playing host to Twitch Plays Pokemon for about a week now, and the game isn't slowing down so far. Anyone viewing this can type commands into the game's chat, and a special bot then interprets the commands for Game Boy's control, up, down, left, right, A, B, or start. The person who created Twitch Plays Pokemon is an Australian programmer who wants to remain anonymous, but they told Polygon in an email that they didn't really have plans for it from the beginning. They just wanted to put it up and see how people would respond. So thousands of people enter commands at any given time, and what results is like chaos, like a crazy explosion. But amongst this chaos, some people have actually made progress. They've battled to win badges, leveled certain Pokemon up, and navigated Ash through a number of the game's puzzles and mazes. There are problems with character getting stuck behind objects like trees, but for the most part, things are actually happening. What's fascinating about this is that this is sort of an experiment in social, in massively multiplayer social gameplay, cooperative gameplay. And I haven't really seen anything quite like this before. And what we're going to link to for the video is not a pre-recorded video of the gameplay, but we're actually going to link to the embed of the actual game being played itself, so that you can spectate or play if you like through Twitch's chat app. Have you guys checked this out at all?
I mean, I took a look at the video. I bet this is the kind of thing that the Ouya should be right on top of, right?
Mm-hmm,
like
mm-hmm.
The Ouya should be reaching out to people like this and being like, how can we get your game on our platform? Because it's like user-created and, you know, super geeky and, you know, like the Ouya should be eating up games like this and games like Minecraft.
Sure.
And it's just kind of weird to see that there's been no growth over there. Well, there's been some growth, but not, you know, bang-up growth.
Sure. I mean, that's a real shame, because I think that consoles like the Ouya or the Game Stick was the other Kickstarter one that I backed. Need to find their killer app that gets users on their system, and this something like the Switch Plays a massively multiplayer cooperative game like this seems ideal for that. The closest thing that this reminds me of is a while back, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, there was a massively multiplayer a game where basically everyone drew. It was like cooperative drawing, and you'd have this enormous sort of drawing field, and you could drill down into like one pixel, and within that pixel you can do a massive sort of, it was in itself a massive drawing field. So that when you zoomed out, you could sort of create a giant picture, like a fractal image of what was down at the root level. And I'll have to find that again, because I think that's still going on. That's the only thing that I've seen that has matched the scale of Twitch Plays Pokemon.
I was never big into Pokemon. I tried one of the games for a few seconds, and I realized how slowly I walked. Someone told me, hey, you'll eventually get roller skates on a bike. And I was like, nope.
You know, I have to admit that I've never been a big Pokemon player myself, but amongst the coworkers at my work who are all like who are all of a younger generation than I. Like Pokemon is the shit. Like that is their obsession. So
yeah, it's actually traversed a lot of generations. I remember my brother was playing it, and quite a lot of people who are within, you know, the gaming community definitely find this as sort of their, you know, mobile go-to game.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
All right. That's it for the show, with the exception of going around the room here, and I'll start with Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DwayneD. You can always see me at gplus.to/DwayneD. And you can always find me here on the Drill Down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. Other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com and r2d2build at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the cool one. I like that.
Yeah.
I get excited about
this level of enthusiasm.
I know. That's genuine enthusiasm. I really get excited about Tosin.
Yeah, I've got an update coming up on some of the things that I, you know, experienced at a hobby convention that I went to last weekend, and also I think this upcoming weekend I will be trying my hand at painting. So probably something about that coming up too.
Yeah, you'll have to put that up on the site. I want
painting the robot.
Yeah, spray painting. Yep. At least
you might hit Andy in an emotional place.
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna start crying any minute. All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and also on Facebook and Twitter at MrBabyMan. For the Drill Down, you can find us at the Drill Down. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let us help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks guys.